going back a number of years, FDA approval was really the, 80% of the focus, and then reimbursement was 20% of the focus. I'd say, maybe not flipped exactly, but the reimbursement piece of this has become more and more important and also more challenging. It truly goes hand in hand. And so you really have two customers. I mean, you have FDA for, and they're looking at effectiveness and safety and building the clinical evidence for them. And, in particular, you have CMS, which is has a different perspective.
Welcome to MedCider, where you can learn from the brightest founders and CEOs in medical devices and health technology. Join tens of thousands of ambitious doers as we unpack the insights, tactics, and secrets behind the most successful life science startups in the world. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedCider, I sat down with Dr. Eric Fain, CEO of Procurian. After graduating from medical school, Eric took a year off and discovered his passion for medtech. He has since held key roles throughout the space, spanning sales, marketing, and R&D for both startups and major players like St. Jude Medical and Abbott. Today, as CEO and president of Procurian, he's leading the development of an advanced percutaneous mechanical circulatory support device. Here for you the key things that we discussed in this conversation. First, to attract investors, develop a compelling story outlining your company's unique value proposition and path to success. If you want to build relationships with potential capital investors and strategic partners well in advance of needing immediate funding, start the conversations early. Second, put yourself in the acquirer's shoes. Evaluate your company from their perspective to identify areas of value and potential concerns. Robust clinical evidence for early stage startups is a must. Also, don't underestimate the importance of a well-developed and documented quality management system. Third, your target market needs to be defined before you can properly develop your regulatory and reimbursement plans. Address coverage challenges early on and engage CMS. Explore partnerships with private payers for both learning and clinical trial opportunities. All right, before we jump into this episode, I wanted to let you know that the latest edition of MedCider Mentors is now live. We just published volume 5, which summarizes the key learnings from the most popular MedCider interviews over the last several months with incredible entrepreneurs like Gabriel Jones, CEO of Proprio, Kirsten Carroll, CEO of Can Do Health, Dr. David Alpert, founder of AliveCor, Greg Bullington, CEO of Magnolia Medical, and other leaders of some of the hottest startups in our space. Look, it's tough to listen or read every interview that comes out, even the best ones, but there are so many valuable lessons you can pick up from the founders and CEOs that join our program. So that's why we decided to create MedCider Mentors. It's the easiest way for you to learn from the world's best medical device and health technology entrepreneurs in one central place. To check out the latest volume, head over to MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. Premium members get free access to all past and future volumes. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. In addition to every volume of MedCider Mentors, you'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. You'll also be able to see all of our playbooks, which are handpicked collections of the most insightful interviews with the brightest founders and CEOs that join our program. Whether you're looking to master capital fundraising, navigate early stage development, tackle regulatory challenges, understand reimbursement, or position your venture for a meaningful exit, MedCider playbooks have you covered. And last, considering that fundraising can be one of the most daunting tasks for any startup, we created a meticulous database of investors right at your fingertips. Explore a wealth of VC funds, private equity firms, angel groups, and more, all eager to invest in medical device and health technology startups. Access to this database is a premium member exclusive, so don't miss out. Learn more about MedCider Mentors and our premium memberships by visiting MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. All right, without further ado, let's jump into the interview. All right, Dr. Eric Fain, welcome to MedCider Radio. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Yeah, really looking forward to diving into your really accomplished, professional journey and kind of what you're up to at Procurian, especially with some of the most recent news. But with that said, I recorded a short kind of condensed bio at the outset of this particular episode, but I always like to start here. You're an MD by background. You have a really, really extensive pedigree. So maybe without going too far into the weeds, give us a sort of an elevator style pitch, kind of overview of kind of what you've been doing leading up to running Procurian as the CEO.
Sure. As you mentioned, I'm an MD by training. As an undergrad, I have an applied math background degree. And really, while I was in medical school, I got involved in some of the early days research of implantable defibrillators. And my advisor there, Roger Winkle, got associated and was heading up a medical advisory board for a startup company called VentureTex. And so when I graduated from medical school, originally I had planned to just take a year off, join the company, help them do some more of the fundamental research and work on some of the product specifications, and really just kind of fell in love with it and decided to kind of take a detour from my original plans of going into clinical medicine and sticking on the medical device development side. Stayed at VentureTex until we were acquired by St. Jude Medical and ended up having a 20-year career there. Ran the cardiac rhythm management division, and then picked up also the neuromodulation division as well, and then eventually became group president over the full St. Jude portfolio. And then we were acquired in the beginning of 2017 by Abbott. I went through the integration process there, but then was thinking about what I wanted to do next, and really kind of thought about getting back to the startup environment, which I loved. And that led me to doing some due diligence for the potential investor for Proservion and eventually taking the CEO job.
Got it. We're recording this in early 24. And it looks like based on your LinkedIn profile, did you join Proservion in kind of mid 2018? Does that sound about right?
Yeah. No, actually, yeah. Summer 2018. That's right.
Got it. So almost 6 years into the journey with the company. So really, really interested to kind of learn what you've been building over the past, you know, handful of years or so. But for those that aren't familiar with sort of the heart failure space, give us kind of a sense of what aortic is, what it does, what it solves for, and then, you know, maybe how it's different versus other kind of, you know, treatments that are a bit more standard of care.
Yeah. So aortic is a pump technology called percutaneous mechanical circulatory support class of devices. And one way to think about it is that there's really been a lot of advances in the treatment and management of chronic heart failure patients, but really have not been any advances for decades in the treatment of patients who have acute decompensated heart failure. So these are patients who are outside the hospital, but then become very sick with heart failure. Symptoms primarily are the result of taking on a lot of excess fluid, and that's manifested by having fluid fill up in the lungs. So shortness of breath is a real hallmark of exacerbation, but also swelling, especially of the lower limbs and feet, and also in more severe cases, also of the belly, where you have fluid buildup and ascites there as well. So those are the patients who get admitted to the hospital, are the hardest to manage and really have very, very poor outcomes. About 25% of these patients who are admitted to the hospital with acute decompensated heart failure are not able to be successfully decongested with standard of care available therapy today. And they stay in the hospital for a long time, but eventually kind of get pushed out and have very, very poor outcomes. About half the patients are either dead or readmitted to the hospital in 90 days to 6 months in time. So those are the patients that we're really focused on. And again, standard of care today primarily is just treatment with high doses of intravenous diuretics, plus or minus some other cardiac medications like inotropes. And so when the patients that we're focused on are, again, that 25% about of patients who are not able to be clinically decongested, aortic device differs from the other real device. It's a percutaneous MCS device on the market, Impella, in that the device goes in similarly, catheter-based through the femoral artery and the groin, but we're positioned in the descending aorta rather than being positioned in the left ventricle of the heart. And because we're positioned in the aorta, really gives us some advantages in terms of safety. We don't need to worry about things like stroke or other things that can be involved in putting a device into the heart itself. But really what differentiates us are the types of patients that we're looking to treat. So again, we're looking for initial indication, we're looking for treatment of these heart failure patients who have acute decompensated heart failure, unable to be treated with standard of care therapy. Impella today is indicated for treating high-risk patients during PCI procedures and also frank cardiogenic shock.
Got it. Yeah, that's super helpful. And for those listening that don't get to the full write-up on MedCiter, Proservion is the website, Proservion.com. So it's spelled P-R-O-C-Y-R-I-O-N.com. P-R-O-C-Y-R.
C-Y-R-I-O-N, Procyrion.com. We'll link to it in the full write-up on MedCiter, as well as Eric's LinkedIn profile too. So that's a really helpful overview. And you know, I'm sure there's a lot of folks that are listening that are you know, sort of involved in the cardiovascular space and are familiar with Impella. So thanks for kind of pointing out kind of how the devices differ at a high level anyway. And I know you recently, I think, announced enrollment of your IDE pivotal trial. But Eric, can you kind of give us, before we kind of go deep into some functional areas of the business and your journey specifically, give us a sense of kind of where the company is at currently.
Yeah, it's been, you know, Procyrion's been around for quite a number of years, and really most of that time has been really solving the engineering challenges of developing a miniaturized pump that is really durable, can stay in the body, in the blood pool, and not only perform well in terms of the pump function, but also not seize up with clots and have other issues. And so when I joined the company in 2018, we're challenged to really get to a pump that could stay in the body and last and be durable. And so that was a lot of the time that we did. And we've been able to accomplish that now. Actually have had the pumps in animals up to almost 5 months running well, which opens the door for some other indications down the road for home ambulatory use. But right now we're really excited. After having completed our pilot study in these acute decompensated heart failure patients back in the third quarter of 2022, we enrolled our first patients in our pivotal trial called the DRAIN-HF trial in November of last year. And we've been really focused on getting sites activated and going and continuing to enroll patients with the goal of completing enrollment by around the end of the first quarter of 2025, beginning of the second quarter of 2025, which would set us up then for our PMA submission to FDA for approval sometime in the late 2025 timeframe.
Got it. Very, very good. Super helpful overview. I think helps generally kind of speaking level set everyone listening for Procyrion's at with respect to its life cycle. So with that said, let's spend the next maybe 20 or 30 minutes diving into kind of some key functional areas. And I'd like to start out with fundraising, and we'll get to maybe kind of your thoughts around, you know, establishing clinical evidence and kind of building out that ClinReg kind of roadmap. But with respect to fundraising, you recently completed your Series E fundraise, which, you know, I'm sure probably wasn't, raising that amount of capital wasn't for the faint of heart. You know, in this market environment, why, I guess really fundraising is never easy, but especially in this kind of market environment, it's especially, you know, challenging. And so when you think about kind of how you're fundraising, you know, today or most recently versus maybe, you know, a handful of years ago, what are some of the key lessons that you've kind of learned along the way and maybe could recommend to other med tech founders and CEOs that are in the throes of raising capital?
The first thing I'd say, sort of tongue in cheek, is timing is everything. So, you know, we're in a really, really, as you said, challenging time for raising capital, and especially in the medical device space and particularly for clinical stage companies, you know, just a lot of perfect storm sorts of things, you know, high interest rates and borrowing costs, and which, you know, VCs having very long diligence timelines. And then also for the VCs, it's really them having to deploy their own funds to support their own portfolio company. So having all that together really creates a difficult environment for medtech startups in raising money. And you know, the general environment also meant that companies that are sort of early stage commercial companies have had low valuations, so you have more competition with there, where investors are looking at not the additional risk of running a clinical trial as well, and M&A activity's been down. So like I said, kind of a perfect storm for right now. But I think in terms of lessons learned, you really can't control timing. But one of the things that we did and allowed us to kind of survive and weather the storm was that we last raised our Series D back in mid 2019 and raised $30 million. And, you know, from the get go. And I think part of that is due to my experience just in a large company environment, just been very, very careful with our cash, really never knowing what's going to come up for us. But the big thing was COVID. We started our pilot study and COVID hit, and that really set us back for a good, you know, year and a half in terms of making the progress that we wanted to. So really have always focused on spending the money where it was critical, you know, saving as much for a rainy day as we could, extending the cash runway. And you know, that allowed us to really have a cash runway that allowed us to kind of survive. But for the, you know, other lessons learned, I think, you know, you have to get out there and talk to a, you know, a really broad group of potential investors from across the board, whether it's VCs, family offices. And we were also lucky to have a very supportive current investor base that we could leverage as well. But, you know, I think it's really having a very clear story, being able to define what your path is for potential investors, giving a timeline that's realistic. And really for our group of investors, it's really being able to bring them along to the details of what separates you from an innovation standpoint, the size of the patient population, and how you can really make a difference.
Yeah. Your comments around this idea that, you know, cash is king and it's so, so crucial. And it sounds, you know, reasonably straightforward, right? But it's always such a hard balance to strike, right? The kind of this idea of really accelerating and moving quickly, but also that typically comes with a fair amount of cash burn. You know what I mean? And so that balance and try to weigh that against how long it's going to take to maybe, you know, get to, you know, raise another round of capital, you know, really, really difficult. And the other thing that kind of stands out, you know, hearing you describe your experiences raising funds is that you've got an incredibly accomplished pedigree, a couple of exits under your belt, and it's not easy, right? Raising money. And there's so many other accomplished entrepreneurs that have come out of the program and mentioned the very same thing, right? And so I think it's just helpful, you know, for anyone listening that, you know, never, you know, raising capital never is easy.
That's true. And I think it's also, you know, having a plan of, you know, not only you're going to raise, you know, some X number of dollars, having a plan of the milestones that you're going to accomplish with that cash, laying that out for investors, making sure that you have the positive feedback that if you accomplish those milestones, that should be the launching point to be able to raise a next round of financing. And I think, again, it's really focusing the spend on where the team can really add value. We outsource a lot of things like manufacturing that is not our core expertise, but, you know, we're going to manage expertly, but we're going to focus on hiring, you know, a small lean team, but we're in the places that is really going to be where we're the subject matter experts and can really add the most value to advancing the programs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to keep in mind, like where are your strengths and lean into those strengths and look at outsourcing properly and other key areas. Let's shift the conversation a little bit to M&A. And I know you did your first startup, VentureTex, to St. Jude, and then ended up running several business units within St. Jude, and then went through a very large M&A transaction when Abbott acquired St. Jude. And so when you think about your experiences kind of going through, you know, a smaller M&A sort of transaction versus a much larger one, give us a sense for kind of, you know, what that was like. And if you go through the same thing, right? Like, how are you approaching those sort of transactions with strategics?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, yeah, definitely the size, you know, it's dependent upon the stage and size of the company and if you're commercial or not commercial. But you know, I think for startup companies, some of the things to really think about are sort of what sort of exits are you looking to do? I mean, there's, you know, it used to be that outside the M&A area, the IPO markets were hot and, you know, that was a good vehicle for exit. But the environment also has changed a lot. So I think that for most sort of single product startup companies today, M&A is probably the most likely outcome. Not to say that you can't build a commercial organization and go on your own, but it's probably less likely today than it was, you know, even 5, 10 years ago. But I think, you know, when you're thinking about it, you really need to sort of wear the hat of the acquirer and think about what's going to be important to them. And so one of the things obviously is going to be how you've built out your clinical evidence, you know, whether and it always starts with the study design and thinking about then the clinical evidence you're going to have at the end, really defining your patient population, defining sort of you may have a single priority program, which most startup companies will, but really thinking about what would be next and sort of laying some early groundwork that acquirers can see that they could pick up and run with. I think one of the things that I can tell you from experience on both sides of the transactions that oftentimes are is overlooked is having a very strong quality system and quality program. A lot of startups, that's the area where there isn't a lot of focus. Having been on the acquire side a number of times with St. Jude, it has become a bigger criteria for acquirers and how they think about companies, because a lot of times you get these small companies, you acquire them, you're really excited about the technology. And then when you get in there and see about really implementing a program within a bigger company, the quality system, if it's not in good shape, can be a real barrier for really scaling up manufacturing, managing the clinical systems that are needed in place to and around. So I would definitely make sure that you have a strong quality system. And I think today also that acquirers, strategics are really digging in and making sure that if they're going to acquire a company, that the quality system really is something that they can leverage.
That's a really good point. It's come up actually, I wouldn't say a lot per se, but there's a few other, experienced founders and CEOs that have brought up something very similar. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of, people are listening to this and thinking, quality, Rob, it's the bare basics. But the reality is, like, as you approach a potential M&A transaction, you're trying to de-risk as much as, everything as much as possible. And if your QMS is a mess, that just represents a very sizable risk, right? It's one more, sort of budget allocation around remediation that a strategic's going to have to consider. And so, I think the message is probably try to limit the number of risks as possible. And that includes obviously the QMS. So,
hey everyone, let's take a quick break to talk about Fastwave Medical, the company I co-founded and lead as CEO. Our team is developing next generation intravascular lithotripsy systems for complex calcific disease. This type of therapy is often referred to as IVL. The market size for IVL is over $9 billion, and there's only one player in the space with a market cap of around $10 billion. So naturally, there's a lot of investor interest in Fastwave. In fact, we opened up an opportunity to invest directly into the company almost a year ago, and we were blown away by the interest from our community. So much so that we ended up closing $8 million from our supporters in less than a month. Typically, opportunities to invest in venture-backed startups like Fastwave are pretty rare, so based on significant and continued demand, we highly encourage you to sign up for our waitlist to avoid missing out on the next opportunity to invest. You can opt in at fastwavemedical.com/invest. And if this is the first time you're hearing about Fastwave, here are some key highlights. As I mentioned before, we are sitting on an IVL market valued at over $9 billion with only one incumbent. Second, we just completed our first in-human study with 8 treated patients, resulting in 100% lesions crossed and a 93% reduction in mean diameter stenosis from baseline. We've raised over $20 million to date from corporate venture and cardiovascular KOLs, and we have 5 granted patents by the USPTO and multiple FTOs. If you're interested in empowering physicians with advanced IVL technology while potentially benefiting from a fast-growing IVL market, head over to fastwavemedical.com/invest and check out the details. Again, that's fastwavemedical.com/invest. All right, let's get back to the rest of the conversation.
We've been very lucky. We have a very strong leader for quality at Procerion, and she has kept everybody focused on the quality system and documentation, and with the idea that, when an acquirer comes in and looks at us, a potential acquirer, that's not going to be an area that they're going to be concerned about, that they have to kind of rebuild or remediate and spend a lot of time and money on.
Got it. And one more follow-up question before we get to kind of the clinical and regulatory topics. And it kind of piggybacks off of the short discussion we had around fundraising. But, considering your experiences, obviously as a CEO of a startup versus, running, several business units inside of a large strategic, are you kind of in favor of trying to approach strategics these days for fundraising and getting involved in earlier stage companies that maybe, seed, series A, even series B rounds versus later stage rounds? What's your general kind of take on that topic in today's fundraising environment?
I think as a baseline, once you sort of have things going, that it's important to educate the strategics in the universe that you're working in about what you're doing and keep them informed, not straying outside of, into confidential material, but really making sure that you're on their radar screen, giving the progress reports and making sure that they know where you are, so that if there's an opportunity for getting them a strategic involved in fundraising, that you're not starting from the beginning. I think in terms of having a strategic invest in the company in the early stage, there are definitely pluses and minuses. But I can tell you in terms of our situation with Procerium, we've had a strategic investor for a while. And I would say that they've been great partners and been very constructive and helpful. In the last fundraising round, our established investors, including our strategic, invested in the Series E above their pro rata. So again, every situation is different, but I think it can be helpful and has been in our case.
And your point about even if it's not the best fit, right? Or maybe you're too early for a strategic to actually participate in a round of financing. Your point about just making engaging with them in some fashion, right? And keeping them informed or abreast of kind of what you're building, the progress you're making. So crucial. And I'm sure you've engaged with a fair number of founders and CEOs that almost approach it like that's a black box. The strategic shouldn't know anything about what we're doing, et cetera. And it's like, I don't think that's really the best approach, right? I mean, typically the sooner you can engage, the better, right? Even if it's just, introductory kind of conversations or kind of the direction you're heading in.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think, one of the things is that the M&A environment has changed and it's a longer road today. There's very few, I'd say, very early stage real acquisitions at this point in time. And I would expect that not to change much in the near, especially in the near term. And I think, just as a startup company, you're sort of, putting out a slide, potential acquirers, the strategic also, they're doing their strategic plans every year and they're looking at what companies are out there that could be interesting for them. And so getting on their radar screen, I think is important just to set the stage for a later event.
Good stuff. Let's transition and kind of into more, a clinical regulatory kind of topic. And I want to highlight first, I guess, the FDA breakthrough device designation that you were awarded, back in 2019, pre-COVID. So when you think about trying to navigate the regulatory landscape, this is, can be one of the more difficult hurdles that a lot of founders and, medtech founders and CEOs need to navigate, especially with novel technology. And so when you think about how to effectively do that, are there one or two things that stand out that have worked really well that you think are really, really important for other entrepreneurs to understand as they approach this kind of functional area?
Yeah, I think the first thing is just deciding, what geography you're going to really focus in. I mean, for us, we really decided that we were going to focus on the U.S. We did some early clinical work in Australia, but, for a company our size and the resources that we have, the U.S. was going to be the place that we really wanted to focus. And so with that in mind, one thing I definitely strongly recommend is establishing a relationship with FDA early on, even before you're ready to do a formal submission. Similar to other comments I've made, educating FDA on the company, the products, what you're trying to accomplish, they're very open and very appreciative of having that early contact and understanding, because it just makes things a lot easier when you do make a submission, when they're on the clock, to be able to jump right in. The other thing I'd recommend is to take advantage of pre-sub meetings. So, there's a number of things early on across the board. You have all the V&V work that you're going to be doing and getting alignment with FDA to make sure that you are going to meet their requirements and approaches is very important. One mistake that's commonly made is to just run off, do the V&V work, look at the, look at all the standards and that's obviously needed and helpful, but investing all the time and cash into doing that work and then approaching FDA and finding out that you have to repeat a number of those because you something's changed or because of your device, they're taking a different sort of perspective. They want you to do testing in a certain way or do additional testing. And that can set you back a long time as well. So having those early conversations with FDA and then, as you move to the clinical stage, it's really important to be talking with FDA about study design, having in mind the clinical evidence that you want to build, but also getting feedback from FDA to get alignment on sort of the high level study design before getting too far along, making sure you're in alignment, making sure that you have a rough idea of the size of the study, types of data that's going to need to be collected to support a future PMA down the road.
Yeah, it's all good stuff. And I think that maybe the common theme here is begin to have those conversations, right? Whether it's with strategics or investors or FDA in this case, or any regulatory body, the sooner you can have those conversations, the better, right? Whether it's through a formal Q-sub process, and then obviously engaging and educating, you know, the review teams through the you know, IDE submissions and whatnot, really, really important. And, you know, I always like to kind of just reemphasize that at the end of the day, these are relationships, right? And you can't expect a review team at FDA or any other regulatory body just to completely understand and really lean into what you're doing, you know, in one meeting, right? Like typically it's going to take a little bit of time. It's going to take a little bit of interaction, right? So the sooner you can have those discussions and conversations, the better.
That's right. It is. I mean, you have to really approach it as a partnership. You know, you have your strategy. You're not going to lay all your cards on the table, maybe, you know, in the beginning, but you want to be upfront. You want to make sure that you build a relationship, and along with that, then being able to have frank conversations and being able to be in a position where there's going to be some give and take, which is always going to be the end result.
Yeah. And I think they're like, you know, for those listening that are kind of weighing, you know, do we do a QSO? Do we go straight to maybe a 510K submission, et cetera? And there's probably scenarios where you maybe want to go right to a submission, right? And there's maybe not a clear need to do a QSO, but generally speaking, that's probably a little bit more atypical, right? And that, you know, again, if you can use an opportunity to present sort of your case, your argument, begin to engage with FDA, you know, earlier on in the journey, the better. But with that said, Eric, let's jump to kind of the topic of clinical data and building out this roadmap and substantiating your safety and efficacy of a device. And, you know, we touched on the fact that you're just now enrolling in this Indrain HF, right? Your pivotal IDE trial here in the US. So I'm sure this is probably a functional area that you're obviously very, very experienced in, considering your background. And so when you think about how to approach, you know, building out, right, this clinical roadmap and, you know, substantiating, you know, certain aspects of your device, how do you typically coach up, you know, other founders and entrepreneurs as they're approaching this topic?
I think it really comes down to, I think, maybe two fundamental things. One is really defining your target patient population. You know, even for something broad like coronary disease or heart failure, really deciding main patient population that you're really going to try and treat, and define something in a patient population where you think you can really differentiate your results from a control, which typically would be standard of care therapy. And then the other piece is that's really important, in that over my career I've learned to really appreciate, is really taking the step back and thinking about what are the claims that you're going to want to make about your device when it's approved. So, you know, as you're promoting devices after you get through the gauntlet of FDA approval, you know, you have to stay within the guys, you know, sort of the guardrails of what data do you have to support the claims that you'd like to make to market the device to drive adoption. And so thinking about those claims early on and then building the data collection into your protocol that can support those claims. And sometimes that goes well beyond sort of the primary effectiveness endpoint. There may be other claims that are going to be very important to you in terms of marketing the device and driving adoption. And you want to be able to make sure that you've built those claims in to the pivotal trial as well.
Got it. It's somewhat of a similar topic, right? But how do you think about, you know, coverage and reimbursement, right? As you're building out, you know, some of these trial designs, because that, you know, I think there's an argument that could be made that, you know, trying to answer the question of who's actually going to pay for this might be the most significant challenge for novel technology, right? Like aortics. And so as you think about that, answering that question, are you factoring that in pretty early into the designs of your clinical studies and trials?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, going back a number of years, FDA approval was really the, you know, 80% of the focus, and then reimbursement was 20% of the focus. I'd say, you know, maybe not flipped exactly, but the reimbursement piece of this has become more and more important and also more challenging. And when you think about, okay, you have an innovative technology and you want to now get it on the market so you can actually treat the patients that you are, you know, is really driving your motivation to to develop these products, it really goes hand in hand. And so you really have two customers. I mean, you have FDA and they're looking at effectiveness and safety and building the clinical evidence for them. And, you know, in particular, you have CMS, which is has a different perspective. You know, it's really about gaining coverage for the Medicare patient population and showing, making sure that you have evidence to not only show across the board all different types of patients, ages, but that Medicare population in particular. And then, of course, depending on the type of device and the patient population you're trying to treat, it may have a large component that are not of Medicare age over 65. And so then it's the whole other list of customers you'd have in private payers.
And I was having a conversation recently, and I won't name his name, but a very, very experienced CEO. And we were talking about clinical trial sites, right? And he mentioned, you know, potentially engaging with most people would think of this as a payer, right? And getting access to not only their sites, but also beginning to build a relationship with this particular payer in advance of, right, commercializing. I thought it was a really good point because the lines between, I mean, as you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but the lines between payers and providers are so blurry, right? That even thinking about, again, kind of under the skies of, under the kind of this theme of building relationships early, you know, potentially thinking about, you know, some of those systems, right, as potential trial sites as well.
And that's absolutely right. I mean, there's more and more of these systems that they are both the provider and the payer. And because they're, you know, sitting with those two hats, they really have a unique perspective about value, about safety, about outcomes. So I think it is something that people need to focus on more and more. And you know, like everything else in the med tech space, it takes time to get through all these processes. So if there's an opportunity to lay the groundwork early, it shouldn't be overlooked.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I want to get to the rapid fire portion of this interview, but anything else, you know, that we didn't cover that you definitely think, you know, you want to highlight or you think is important to mention that would be, you know, especially valuable for other med tech founders and CEOs?
I think we've covered all the big things. I mean, the reimbursement piece as well. I think one other thing I'd highlight is that another opportunity if you can take it and, you know, you should get it. This summer, we got approval for some new ICD-10 codes for the aortic system. And, you know, we were able really to leverage the groundwork that Impella had, and there was a set of codes that Impella had, but they were specific for placing a pump in the heart. And obviously we're in the aorta. So, but we were able to work with get a parallel set of codes established and approved that are in force now, went into force beginning of October, the beginning of the fiscal year for the government. And that sets us up for not only good reimbursement during the HF pivotal trial, but also sets us up well for eventual commercialization.
Yeah, such a good point. And I'm glad you brought that up because as you know, if you're listening to this and you're in the process of mapping out and scoping out, right, what your, you know, pivotal trial is going to look like in a sense, if you haven't kind of answered that question around payment, really, really important, right? And if there's an opportunity to kind of leverage reimbursement, you know, like your team did, man, you got to take the bull by the horns because that I'm sure that's going to be really, really helpful as you enroll patients over the next, you know, months. So very, very good. So with that said, again, for everyone listening, we'll get to the rapid fire portion of this interview here over the next 5 minutes, but Procurian.com is the website. That's Procyrion, Procurian.com. We'll link to it in the full write-up on MedSider, of course, as well as Eric's LinkedIn profile too. So that said, we'll spend the next 5 minutes kind of covering rapid fire questions. Eric, these are rapid fire nature. If you want to expound a little bit, feel free to do so. But first question on the docket is when you think about the next 12 months, right, ahead for Procurian, what are you most excited about?
Yeah, I'm most excited about the DREAM-HF study, really driving enrollment, getting that done. We believe that we'll be able to show significant improvement in these patients, being able to decongest them, keep them alive, keep them out of the hospital. So really excited about that.
Yeah, I can imagine such a huge inflection point for the company itself. All right, since taking on the CEO role of Procurian back in mid-2018, what's the most surprising thing that you learned?
I think probably the most surprising thing is that you can never plan enough, and you're going to have things that come up that are just out in the blue. I mean, COVID being a good example. And then it's really that, especially with a small dedicated team, having everybody rally around it and come up with good solutions and keep pushing ahead.
That's good stuff. Yeah. Always try to peek around the corner, right? You know, there's like known things that you're aware of that you want to try to address and plan for, but there's always the unknowns, right? That you need to sort of be thinking about too. So good stuff. All right. If you had, let's say you had a room full of life science entrepreneurs, maybe we're in the Bay Area, and you just wrapped up a presentation and want to leave them with one key take home message that's going to best set themselves up for success with their venture, what would that lesson be?
I think, we've covered a lot of it. I mean, I think the lessons would be about, being proactive, really thinking about the fundraising, how you're going to approach it. You can have all great programs and great ideas, but you obviously need the funding to be able to carry those things out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm sure you probably know a handful of, founders or CEOs that really hate fundraising. And it's like, it can be very, very challenging, but if it's part of the game, right? Maybe it's the most important thing.
Yeah.
That you do is keep money in the bank. So definitely something you want to lean into and try to think a lot about or spend a lot of time thinking about. So, all right, last question on the docket. Let's say you had the opportunity to kind of go back in time, step inside the old time machine, maybe to your late 20s. What's one thing you'd tell kind of the younger Eric Fain from a professional standpoint?
I think I'd say, find something you're really passionate about and really kind of drive in that direction. I mean, everybody spends a large portion of their time at work, and in order to really get a lot out of that and come to work every day enthusiastic, it's really something, find something that you're truly passionate about and follow that.
That's good stuff. Yeah. And your story, even with Procerian, is a great example of you've been at this for nearly 6 years now in the throes of some really important, clinical work, but that's a long journey, right? I mean, med tech in general, to build a company and have some success, it's not a two or three year sprint. It's usually much longer, and so to be interested and passionate about what you're working on is so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Again, everyone, procerion.com is the website, P-R-O-C-Y-R-I-O-N, procerion.com. We'll link to the full write-up on MedCider. And Eric, I'll have you hold on the line. But again, you made it this far. Thanks, everyone, for your listening attention. Definitely encourage you to check out the full write-up, which on MedCider, which will summarize a lot of the key insights and experiences that Eric shared with us kind of throughout his own professional journey and really over the last, handful of years with building Procerion. So definitely encourage you to check that out if you're new to MedCider. Those are useful resources that we provide at no cost to everyone that digs these interviews, loves the MedTech startup story. So with that said, thanks as always for your listening attention. Until the next episode of MedCider goes live, everyone, take care.
Hey, it's Scott again. One quick thing before you go. You see, I love bringing you insightful conversations with the best founders and CEOs of medical device and health technology startups. But here's the thing. I'd be super grateful if you could help me reach even more ambitious doers who share our passion. So if you found value in this podcast, if you found yourself nodding your head while listening, or if you simply enjoy what we're doing with MedCider, please take a moment to leave us a review. It's super easy. Just open your Apple Podcast app or the podcast app of your choice, search for our show, and scroll down to the ratings and reviews section. Leave your honest thoughts and hit that 5-star rating if you think we're worthy. Your feedback is incredibly important, and it's the best way to ensure we keep bringing you awesome discussions with leading founders and CEOs. So take a moment to be a good friend and leave that review today. As always, thanks for being a part of our journey and for helping MedCider continue to grow and evolve. Your support is greatly appreciated. All right, enough talk about reviews. Stay tuned for another informative episode coming at you soon.